Coming up on Boston Public Radio, he's the Secretary of Transportation. He used to run the T. Ridge Davey joins us in studio to answer your questions and ours. Andrus Nelson's the 34-year-old new conductor of the Boston Symphony, starts his new job tomorrow. Jared Bowen, who spent time with Nelson, spends time with us to preview the man and the music.
Editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGroy, reveals what he did when, as a rabid Sox fan, he had to decide. Does he watch last night's mayoral debate, co-sponsored by his own newspaper, or the Red Sox playoff game? Stay tuned. Our analysts on what we learned last night at that debate about John Conley and Marty Walsh, and then the great white-collar crime of history. What is it? The useless, boring office meeting. All that up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He is Jim Browdy, and I am Marjorie Egan.
I thought with a long pause we were going to be shut down today, but apparently it was just
I was arranging my papers here so I could be ready for the secretary.
Great. So we're kicking off today with our recurring segment. We call it Ask Thee, where we invite a public official on to take our questions and yours. The person being interrogated, is that? Well, yes,
sure.
Interrogated
deposed,
today by us.
Whatever.
Yeah. And by you. That's the voice of Richard Davey. Rich is the Secretary and Chief Executive Officer of the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. Secretary Davey, it's great to see you.
As always, Jim, Marjorie, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
I'm just curious.
We're not on the subway line here at WGBH. How'd you get here today?
Unfortunately,
Secretary?
I drove.
It's okay. It's
you're a big subway taker, we should say, in your defense. Are you,
I do,
you're a big
yeah.
T user.
Absolutely. Took Green Blue Line this morning to a morning meeting, and I love it. I mean, I don't own a car, so I have a state, pool car we use to get me around if I got to go to meetings and stuff. But on a day-to-day basis, average Joe citizen, I'm on the T.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Secretary Davey will be with us for a half hour if you have questions for him. And based on the email, you've got plenty of questions.
Great.
Please call him in.
So Bill Weld, when he was the governor of the Commonwealth, with great fanfare, all the cameras were out there from the TV stations and the newspapers. He knocked down the tolls out in western Massachusetts.
He did.
And I believe our intrepid reporter, Emily Rooney, from Greater Boston, informs us that they are back. How come
they're
back?
She is correct. Well, because no one's running for the United States Senate right now. And we all figured it out that the turnpike is in tough shape. I mean, with all due respect, I mean, it was a little gimmicky back in 1996. But this was part of the big finance discussion that we had back in July, and it was to reinstate the tolls. So the tolls out between 1 and 6 will raise another about $12 million, which we'll then invest in that area out in the Berkshires, out in western Massachusetts. A lot of work has to be done, and that's what we're teed up to do.
You know, we hear this all the time, and we get some emails in this regard, too, about mm-hmm. people being upset that the toll burden falls on people coming in from the
read
West.
Read it. Here's mostly. Diane. She sent an email on exactly that topic,
thank you,
Marjorie.
Diane. I didn't realize you had articulated it so wonderfully. Okay. Please ask Transportation Secretary why only people traveling north, west, east must pay tolls, but if you travel South Shore into Boston, no tolls.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Diane. And in fact, one of the suggestions that the administration had was to eliminate all tolls and raise the gas tax, because at least it's geographically equitable to some extent. That didn't happen with the legislature. They decided to do something else. But we owe the legislature a report by the end of the year about how we might toll elsewhere. The bottom line is we are looking at it to toll elsewhere. Border tolls, for example. I know I hear from a lot of folks that when they cross up to New Hampshire, you know, the Hooksett tolls, I guess it's exit 9 or 8. Why not have something similar coming into Massachusetts? Coming into Boston, the same thing. So we're looking at that. I can't just put up tolls on the interstate. We need federal highway approval to do that.
Yep.
So on 93, 95, I just can't do it tomorrow. So we need some federal approval as well. Bottom line, though, Diane, is I don't disagree when we're looking at it.
So $12 million you make by having the tolls in western Massachusetts. You lose roughly, I think, $160 million by the legislature's rescinding and the governor signing the repeal of the short-lived tech tax, which was part of this transportation infrastructure funding thing. You only got a little bit more than half of what you and the governor wanted to begin with. Now you've lost maybe close to a third of that. How do you do what you and the governor say weren't nice ideas but essential ideas with such short money?
No, it's a great question, great point, Jim. I mean, the tech tax largely actually was not for transportation.
It wasn't?
It was part of the transportation package, so it's not a real big deal in my world, but certainly in other worlds, it's going to have an impact potentially depending on what the budget looks like. To your point on how are we going to get there when we got half a loaf, you know, the governor's asked us to really look at how we can accomplish some things over the next 5 years, 10 years, and we will be able to. Actually, we're going to put out a draft capital plan in the next couple of weeks, which specifies here are the things that we want to do. And most of it's going to be investments in our current system, very little some expansion, but mostly investments in our current system, new subway cars, just doing the regular maintenance that has to happen.
But one of the things I know you're doing, I had the opportunity to speak on the South Shore recently, and it was the day or two after some environmental approval was given that was long waited for South Coast Rail.
Right.
And every time we discuss transportation, particularly with someone who's more conservative fiscally than some others, say, how can we afford that sort of multi-billion dollar expansion at the same time that you and the governor say we're short in terms of basic maintenance, repair, and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, and I think I would reject the and or principle. We have to have one or the other. And I think our point has always been we need both. So we need to make a significant investment in our current system. And the proposal we had was to spend about 80% of the revenue in our current system and use about 20% for expansion.
That's if you got $1 billion, which you didn't get even close to.
We didn't get close to that, about half of that. But we are looking at the overall state capital plan to see if there's other bandwidth or flexibility. So, you know, more to come there. We're seeing if we can stretch that half. But then to your point, I mean, if you go to New Bedford, Fall River, you know, those are two large urban areas here in Massachusetts that have largely been left behind. We believe strongly that the rail can be a big economic boost for them. If you spent time in, you know, Lowell or even downtown Haverhill lately, I mean, these places that you wouldn't think are having, you know, a downtown nightlife, condominiums and whatnot. You're seeing folks live in these cities and getting on commuter rail to come into Boston. So we feel like it's going to be an economic boon for the South Coast region.
We're talking to Richard Davey, the Secretary of Transportation. Our number is 877-301-8970. If you have any calls for him, 877-301-8970. Before we get to those calls, Rich, I think you told me this before, but I'm going to ask you again because I forget what you told me. You don't have a car. You don't have a car. So what do you do when you want to go somewhere? Zip car.
Yes,
zip
I have
car.
A zip car. In fact, I'll pull the card out. We're on radio, so
we believe
see
you.
It. You believe
yeah.
me? Are you sure? I don't believe me. Now, and I'll tell you a quick funny story. It was my wife. It was her.
Yes, he has
her
a Zipcar car.
Thank you very much.
Yes, okay.
Exactly. Is this sponsored by Zipcar now? Make sure we get some commercial. But no, it was a gift from my wife, actually. We had a car. We gave it up. We actually donated it, I think, to the Home for Little Wanderers. So we live
good
in Boston.
You.
It's very easy for us. It doesn't make sense for other people, no doubt. We don't have kids. So personally, it's a very easy choice for us. For others, obviously not. But Zipcar is really convenient.
So you want to go leaf peeping on the weekend. You just rent, reserve it and you
do
can
that.
Take off on the
Absolutely.
Weekend.
We're going to get to your calls in a couple of seconds at 877-301-8970. I live in Cambridge, as you know, and I have a Cambridge colleague, Jeff, who works upstairs. And we often talk about how these days we feel captive because it's almost impossible to get out of Cambridge to come over here. Lots of necessary bridge and road repairs.
Right.
And they're going on all over the place. Yep. We know that Callahan's closing around Christmas time for 3 months.
But the Longfellow under construction right now.
The first goal for everybody would be no closings, even though we like to be safe. The second goal is to at least know what's going on. I read a couple of days ago, you've got this new notification deal where people can actually find out what obstacles they're going to face where and when. Is that true?
It's
what's
very
the deal
true.
With that?
No, so it's on our website, but you can go to our website. But Gov Delivery is what it is, Jim, and you can sign up and ask for
one word: Gov Delivery.
Gov Delivery. You can ask for information specific to a project that's in your neighborhood or in your area. So in Cambridge, you could sign up and get information from us on Longfellow Bridge closings, for example. If you live in Fall River, you might care about the Braga Bridge, or in Weymouth and Quincy, you might care about the Fall River.
So
Bridge.
Once you sign up, you will. Without asking again,
without prompting,
get information
that's
about
exactly
those
right.
routes or
real-time
those places.
Traffic updates, et cetera. And we also have a new app called RideWise you can actually download, and you can get real-time traffic information right now on 93, 95. Obviously, you shouldn't be reading that when you're driving, but before you leave or if you're a passenger in a car. So getting people more information has been a real hallmark of what we're trying to do.
Okay, our number is 877-301-8970. If you have questions for the Secretary of Transportation, want to take some calls here, Secretary? You're ready to go, Rich?
I am ready.
Okay, let's go to, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Viviani from Malden.
Hi, thanks for calling. My call is Viviani.
Hi, Viviani. How are you?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Viviani.
Very good. Thank you for having me. My question is, isn't the Secretary Rich? Hi, Rich. Thanks for being on the show.
Sure. Thank
sometimes
you.
Sometimes need cars, right?
So yes.
So he's deep a car or hump in a cab. my point is, not every citizen can have the luxury of take a cab or use a Zipcar. So,
right.
Therefore, how raising the toll would help directly in public transportation? Because really, raising and putting more tolls is only going to make people that can afford cars pay more. But people that need to take public transportation is going to continue to suffering with all the delays. Like, well, there is leaves on the track or the car is disabled, because it's very challenging go to point right. A to point B in the morning by T.
So do you take commuter rail or the orange line?
I take the blue line and the green line.
The blue and green line. So, no, it's a great point. And I think, you know, in the future, if we're talking about sort of how we fund transportation in the future, actually, you know, having flexibility to use some of those toll revenues to, and frankly, invest in transit would be helpful. But right what we have before us, though, is a big plan to make significant investments in our current system. We know we're running red line cars that were built in 1969, by the way. The entire orange line fleet was built in 1979. So they should have been retired a decade or more ago. So we have to, and we're going to be talking about how we're going to make investments in our current system first, because your point's well taken. There are a lot of folks who use our system. It's not by choice. It's because that's their only mode of transportation.
So where does this – thanks, Viviana, for the call. Where is all the money coming from? We talked about you got roughly half of what you wanted from the legislature. South Shore rail expansion is necessary, replacing whatever you just said, red line cars necessary, plus yep. maintenance, plus repair. Where's all the money coming from?
Well, look, I mean, the legislature did make a big step forward, Jim, so we are going to be able to make some investments now, but things are going to have to fall off the list. The list that the governor and we put out back in January, we're going to have to reprioritize them, or some of them are going to have to be pushed out, right? We're not going to be able to do them in year 5. We might have to do them in year 12. And we're going to be very clear about that when we publish our capital plan. These are the outcomes you can expect. Maybe the number of structurally deficient bridges is going to increase, or maybe the number of potholes is going to increase. But these are the trade-offs. And the more transparent I think we can be with folks, these are the trade-offs that we have. I think the better decisions that can be made, hopefully get more politics out of the decision-making. You know, I've been told from time to time, I have folks come up to me and say, Secretary, I've been waiting for this project since 1987. And it's my turn. I said, well, what's the relevance of that project today? Well, that doesn't matter. I've been waiting since 1987, and I deserve. So getting aside of that and saying, well, what's the relevance of today's projects as well? We can also use our infrastructure more smartly, if you will. You probably saw on the Globe a couple weeks ago. Sorry, Marjorie, I mentioned the Globe.
It's okay.
DMUs, these diesel multiple units, subway-like cars, essentially, we can run on commuter rail tracks. So we're not building big new tracks and signal systems. We're just buying more flexible cars that we can use. So, again, being smarter about our infrastructure is going to be an important way as well.
Well, we have another complaint via email from a T-rider, Stephen, who wants to know, Steve wants to know what happened to the 3-car trains on the green D line. And he also is complaining about not enough information when they say we are experiencing delays on the green line due to a disabled train. According to Steve, anyway, they don't tell you which line it is, how long the delay is, whether it's inbound or outbound. They need more information. So
on the 3-car question, Steve, thank you for the question. I've noticed it too, because I'm on the green line pretty frequently. The challenge has been our car count, which is to say making sure we have enough cars each day to have the 2-car trains and then being able to add the 3-car trains. So that's been a real maintenance challenge. Buying new green line cars, which is one of the things we've been talking about doing, will allow us to run more 3-car trips. On the information question, I, again, totally agree. I think we've done a better job of at least trying to say whether it's outbound or inbound, because I know that can be very confusing. I think part of the challenge of the green line is many instances we don't know how long the delay is going to be. So if we think we can fix it and move it, it might be a modest delay. We don't want to scare people into saying, look, it's going to be a long delay when we think we can actually fix it. So there's always a balancing act between the information we have in the field and updating customers as quick as possible. But inbound, outbound, there's no excuse. We should be getting better information.
He says, and I don't know if he's correct or not, but he says you're not telling people whether it's the B, C, D, or E line.
In my experience on the system, I do hear a particular line. He may have had – there may have been an issue that have come up recently which we didn't. And again, Steve, no excuse. The more – we should be giving the customer every bit of information that we have and as quickly as possible.
Our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to speak directly to Secretary Davies, Secretary of Transportation. Paul, you're in Somerville and you're on with Rich Davey. Hey, Paul.
Hello.
Hi, you're on.
Good afternoon. Yeah, Rich. I'm a native of Somerville. I went to high school and college in Boston, and I took the T back in the late 70s and 80s. Now, I actually work in Somerville, live in Somerville. And I actually could walk to work, but for whatever reasons, I actually drive to work. And one thing I notice about transportation, even if people that could take the T, whether it's selfishness, whether it's for whatever reasons, they usually drive their cars. Now, because someone drives a car, I don't consider them to be an evil person like some of these people that are on their bikes.
Jim,
Marjorie's one of these Brookline liberals. Jim's one of the Cambridge liberals.
True.
And I feel as though Somerville's been infected because we used to be more blue-collar, working-class guys. Now we've been infected by their mindset. But the point I'm trying to make...
I love that, infected.
When I'm driving now, I notice I'm a busybody. I look at everybody. I know
you're not paying attention. You're telling the Secretary of Transportation you're not paying attention to the road, Paul. Do you realize that?
Well, I'm still a pretty good driver.
Okay, all
right. Okay, so what's your question, Paul?
The vast majority of people in their cars are in their cars by themselves.
Amen. Yeah.
We do not carpool as much as we complain about the price of gas.
Yeah.
All the good liberals that say they're going to help each other. I actually give strangers a ride in my car, but I actually tell them what I do for work, and I tell them that you shouldn't be too trusting of people. You seem like a pretty squared away guy. I looked at your resume, but you did work for the Jesuits, and sometimes they believe socialism is the answer to the system. And that's definitely.
I was infected by the Jesuits. That's right.
Hey, Paul, there are a lot of questions in there. Thank you for a great call. Take whatever you want, Secretary. The thing about one person cars, sure. Guilty as charged, by the way, and so much traffic in Boston, it's almost constant gridlock. What do you say to Paul?
Yeah, so I mean, a couple things, Paul. I think we could do a better job of helping people, and I think technology is actually going to help as well in this regard, but we could do a better job of telling people what kind of. Opportunities there are, whether it be vanpool or car share, transit management associations that are out there. We should be doing a better job marketing that. We've got a few ideas on how to do that. Reverse commute's another one. I've heard from a lot of businesses outside of Boston whose employees live in Somerville, these infected areas of Somerville and Cambridge who want to get out to the suburbs, get on a commuter rail train, but they're still then a half a mile or a mile away from work. So I think there's a lot, your point is well taken, which I think there's probably some smaller things that we can continue to do to encourage either more mode shift, as I would call it, which is getting people out of those cars and walking or car sharing or on transit.
You know, Secretary Davies, we said we had a mountain of emails in anticipation of your coming here. Manuel from Lexington asked a question that is near and dear to my heart. Texting while driving is a terrible problem.
It is.
There's hardly a day on the turnpike I don't see driving slow in the second lane, drifting out of their lane, et cetera, et cetera. One, why not do more fines, stop more people by troopers, et cetera, and use that money to pay for the program of monitoring these things? Or... and I am totally with this. How about, Manuel says, the flip of a switch. Turn off the considerable technology that's required to track service and enable the problem of texting so people couldn't do it unless they stopped their car on the side of the road. That would do it. I mean, that technology exists. So what are you contemplating on the texting while driving?
Yeah, car? First of all, I want to acknowledge this. Massachusetts actually has, by national standards, the safest roads in America. But it's very clear to me, both here and then nationally, this is a huge and growing problem. I think that... the Globe again, sorry, had an article on Sunday about this, and it's really about behavior, that we have sort of this innate desire to check your cell phone or your text message or what have you, and it's really a behavior question. And they were making it akin to Friends Don't Let Friends Drink and Drive, which is probably the most successful marketing campaign that U.S. transportation has ever done before.
Speaking of drinking and driving, Virginia Tech, you saw the study a couple of years ago, said that texting while driving is as dangerous as drinking while
and probably
driving.
More prolific because... the social norms are different in that regard. And so it's a real challenge. So a couple things. One is we passed a law last year, 2 years ago, on the books. It's hard to enforce because it's very difficult for a trooper to – you can still dial a phone.
You can't distinguish it's using real, your – right, exactly.
That's hard.
Right.
And then we have talked to some folks who you can download technology onto your cell phone that allows you to shut it off while you're driving. But it still requires some manual input. What do I mean? The phone can't distinguish between a driver versus a passenger, for example. I'm not sure that the technology can quite distinguish between whether you're driving or whether you're stopping. So there still has to be a manual, I think maybe probably working with car insurance as well, maybe another place to do that. If people
are you doing that? I mean, are you urging insurers to give refunds or give deductions in premiums if people download that technology?
That we have not had that conversation yet.
It's a good idea, though, isn't it?
It's a good idea, but we have had the conversation with some of the technology folks about the downloading, et cetera. But it is going to be a continued problem, for sure.
Now, before we get back to the calls, this is something we got quite a few emails about. You a music fan, Rich David?
A little bit.
Okay, I assume you know the song. You may have heard of the song, the Safety Bounce. Are you familiar with that
song? I have
song?
Heard of that, yes.
Okay,
indeed.
That is a Tee product. Is that not correct?
Yes, it was not done by Psy. It was
okay,
a Tee product, exactly.
Now, do you know the words to the Safety Bounce?
Truthfully, I don't.
So you can't sing it?
I cannot sing it.
Oh,
okay.
We're so
you
can't? Disappointed.
I can't, no.
Yeah,
so
verses.
Can we hear a little piece? For those who haven't heard and seen this video, which is, do you
it's
like
great.
The video?
It's great, oh yeah.
Here it is.
Hands on wheels. Hands on wheels. How's that? Hold your kids, don't yell on the phone, let others off before you get on and bounce. When you ride it out,
do the safety bounce. When you ride it out. Now, are you a little embarrassed that you have no ability to either recite the word? I mean, be honest here. Either...
No, well, I'm embarrassed for many things in my life, but not this. I have no musical talent to speak of, so no.
Okay, incidentally, before we get back to the calls, thank you for that. Apparently, a deal on the shutdown and the default is being announced on the Senate floor imminently, and Ted Cruz, probably most significantly, the senator from Texas, in a press conference saying he will not block a vote, which means theoretically this could all get done before the midnight deadline.
I hope so.
Back to the calls, 877-301-8970.
Well, just before we get back to the calls, this is an email. This is from Bill in Kingston, who has to be the last follow-the-rules kind of driver alive.
I love Bill.
He's talking about when you drive south on Route 3 and you get to the Sagamore Bridge, if you are going over the Sagamore Bridge, you're supposed to get in the left lane.
Yes.
If you're getting off at Buzzards Bay, you're supposed to get in the right lane. But nobody does that because they just stay in the right lane, pass all the cars on the left, and then merge in so that they can get over the Sagamore Bridge faster. I happen to be one of those offenders.
I was going to say, you were saying it was such...
Yes, but Bill wants to know, because he doesn't like this, he wants to know if there's any discussion of making the exit to segregate those people that are going over the bridge from those who aren't, and exit only and forcing them to get off in Buzzards Bay, or having state troopers there to give out tickets. I hope you're not going to do either, Secretary, but Bill,
I'm going to be extraordinarily honest. The answer is no. There have been no discussions. I think the ticketing, I'm not sure about that, but if there's a way for us to create a barrier potentially a short time out, we'll look at it. I will definitely look at it.
Yeah, don't look at it.
Don't look at it. I'm sorry.
No.
And we will be ticketing Marjorie next summer.
Bill, you're an honest man.
877-301-8970. It's the voice of the Secretary of Transportation, Richard Davey. Let's go to Dave in Rochester. You're on with Secretary Davey. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon, all.
Hi.
The question I have is an infrastructure question.
Yep. Yep. Sure.
I was driving down from Maine on Monday, coming back home from a trip to Maine, and the bridge over the Merrimack River on 95 looked like a blooming disaster. And if I drive on 195 into New Bedford and get off on the exit on Route 18 there and look up, it's a nightmare. If you've been working on the Braga Bridge for 5 years or forever, I'm not sure which is shorter. And I'm just curious as to what's going on. I know that you've got, you know, capital improvements and you've got infrastructure repair. But man, our bridges are a disaster. I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks for the call.
So, Dave, the answer is they are a disaster, and which is why we've been making a significant investment in our bridges. We've reduced the number of, it's a parlance, but structurally deficient bridges in the Commonwealth by 20% in the last 5 years. I think the bridge you're referencing on 95, the Whittier Bridge, is under construction. We started a project there about 2 months ago. It will be a massive reconstruction of the bridge between Amesbury and Newburyport, huge project. The Braga Bridge, yes, it's we've been working on it, but really just spot maintenance because we haven't been able to afford. This is part of the challenge. We're up there just kind of slapping on some concrete and making some basic fixes, leaving knowing it's not the problem. Or not, we haven't solved the problem. The Braga Bridge, we just broke ground on a big project, a $250 million project, again, probably about 35, 40 days ago. That's a 3-year project, but at the end of it, it will be an entirely reconstructed bridge with a 50 to 75 year lifespan. So you are exactly right. We have kicked the can for too long in transportation here in the state, and we have a lot of work to do in making up for it. I have to say, though, too, you know, it's a national problem. It's not just Massachusetts. Pennsylvania, in fact, has, I think I was reading today, 1 in 4 of its bridges are, you know, have significant problems.
What percentage of ours have significant
about
problems?
About 1 in 10.
And if you're driving over one of those 1 in 10, which is not currently being fixed, what are you supposed to think? I mean, what do you, if it's identified?
Say your prayers.
No, I'm serious. The term's structurally deficient.
Right.
All these things that make a lot of people nervous.
Yes.
I think they should. You probably think, well, it should make the legislature nervous. What should you be even driving over one of those bridges?
You absolutely can. So first of all, we don't have anything that is unsafe open. We actually have about 35 bridges that are closed in the state right now because we've determined, forget about all the parlance, that it's not safe to drive over those closed, period. For those that have that are on our list of concerns, we're out doing more rigorous inspections. The Casey Overpass is a perfect example in JP. We've been opening and closing that and doing temporary repairs. We actually want to take it down. The Bowker Overpass in Boston is another one. We've been making some temporary repairs with the idea to make some permanent fixes. So we know exactly where these issues are. Some bridges are weighted. So for the average driver, it doesn't mean anything. But if you're a trucker, that means you actually have to go in a different route. And that's posted. So when you see the big truck signs or the big truck, the little truck, the really small truck, that means that the sign or the bridge is actually weighted, which means if the truck is too heavy, it can't go over it. So no, people should not be scared. But people should know that if we don't fix these things, that then we will have to close them over time. There's no doubt about it.
You know, this is sort of just a philosophical question, but
it
does strike me from time to time when I drive around the state. Here we are, the richest country in the world, and sometimes we look like we're a third world country with the state of the roads, and
sure.
We just don't fund these things. I mean, is it just the way it is? We're going to have 1 in 10 bridges in trouble and potholes, and I mean, we don't want to pay for these things. We can't raise the taxes to do it.
So a couple of comments. I think one, and this is one of the reasons why. There's this problem. So this is Rich Davies' opinion. One of the reasons why this stuff is going on in Washington right now, I think we've been told for too long that we can have it all and we don't have to pay for it.
Right.
And I think in the country, we need to actually make a choice. Either we're going to have it all and invest in it, or we're going to tolerate potholes and in the case of transportation, we're going to tolerate a lesser form of services. Government services cost money. Now, certainly, we in government have to be delivering a better product, a cheaper product, a more quick product, no doubt about that. But this fundamental idea that government services don't cost money is crazy. And I think we've been served up this phony notion that you can have it all and you don't have to pay for it.
I think there's another angle there, if I may.
Okay, you may.
I'm not sure the public is – you didn't use the word. I'll use it – clueless as some might think. I think the problem is this, and love your comment – is it on issues like bridges and roads, a legislator, when they're approached by you and Deval Patrick, or the generic Rich Davey and Deval Patrick, they know you're right, but they make a calculation. Is the bridge that's in my district going to be so dangerous that people can't ride over it while I'm still here as an elected official? If it turns out it's going to be okay for 8 years and I'm going to retire in 8 years, I think their attitude is I'm not voting for a tax increase for that. If you're shaking your head. But
yeah.
Don't you think that's the – whether it's Social Security or bridges or water mains that are 100 years old under streets in New York City and Boston, isn't that the calculation?
Jim, you're making the argument again for term limits.
Well, maybe I am.
The governor has a great way of saying it, which I think is trust the voters. Be honest with people and trust the voters. You're absolutely right, Jim.
Thank you. Let's leave it at
that.
Let's take a few more calls if
we
can. Let's go to Bill in the North Shore. You're on with Rich Davey. He's the Secretary of Transportation. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thanks. I had a question about Massachusetts road signage and how they can tend to be not so friendly to outsiders.
I love the word signage, by the way. I'm glad you used it. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering, because when you is there a thing in Massachusetts that – is there a reason why the main road is never listed when you approach the intersection?
I guess I'm befuddled by that question. No, Bill, there's no reason why that shouldn't be. Is it a local road or what? Do you have an example?
Generally, what you usually see the side road listed,
yeah.
You don't usually see the main road. And yes, there's a lot more GPSs out there, but still, you go to Baltimore and you're going to see driving down a main road the cross. Roads are even hung by cables across the middle of the road.
Yeah.
They're even lit at nighttime if it's a major intersection. So here it's very, especially the way the roads wind so much more than in other parts of the country.
Right.
Having that additional signage would be much more helpful for people that are not from Massachusetts.
No,
thank you, Bill.
I appreciate that. And I can bring that back to my team and certainly the cities and towns as well.
By the way, you're not leaving yet, don't forget, what you always do before you leave, which is stunning to me, is you give it's your personal email, right? Mm-hmm. It goes directly to you.
Sure.
And you actually look at this, correct?
Richard.Davey. It's very, very simple. Richard,
D-A-V-E-Y.
@state.ma.us.
Fair enough.
If you're looking for any state official, it's their first name, period, their last name, at state.ma.us.
Anybody ever email you and say, Rich, you're doing a great job? Or do you get all complaints?
No. In fact, I think actually, so email, I tend to get a little more, I'd say, constructive criticism.
Yeah.
But in person, 99% of folks who will come up to me on the T or in the public, someone grabbed me yesterday. Was, I think, a firefighter. And when I was walking home and said, hey, great job. And we talked
terrific.
A little bit. I said the same thing. You guys are obviously doing a great
good,
job. We talked a little bit
exactly.
about the marathon.
You're kind of in a thankless job in many ways. So let me ask you something that was a great story from the summer. Over at the Alewife station, there was a lot of problems with bicycle theft. So there was this burly cop actually was a cardboard cop watching over the bike racks, and it cut theft significantly.
Who says you have to have big ticket items to solve a problem, right?
How's the cardboard cop doing? Is he still in business over there at Alewife station?
There's a picture of my wife in the refrigerator. The same thing. So if I'm going for a popsicle, that's where the... No, I'm totally kidding, honey. I'm going to be listening. He's doing great. I mean, it's so interesting. It goes back to the psychology. Like, there's a whole behavior we talked about earlier. It's behavior, it's psychology. There was another study I read. It was in Holland or something that if you're speeding, there's a face that will be pictured and it will have a frown. And if you're driving, you know, at the speed limit, there'll be a smile. And it decreased the number of speeding, you know, cars by like 50% or something.
Really?
Yeah. Behavior and psychology is so totally interesting. In any event, yes, bike thefts are down dramatically at Alewife just because we have a cardboard cutout.
Might the cardboard army increase anytime soon?
We'll see. You know, we'll see. We'll
we
have
spoke to the head of the transit police about this.
And Paul McMillan,
yeah. Yeah, that's who, I think that's who it was. Or maybe the number two guy, I'm not sure. And he said that even after people realized that the cop was not real, a bike theft was still reduced just because of the psychological something or other. Rich,
I could see that.
Oh, yeah.
I could see that, absolutely.
Go ahead.
One of your great innovations that Marjorie and I both were dying to do and didn't make it in season was the Cape Flyer.
Oh, yeah.
This, the beginning, the new beginning of the train to the Cape. One, what kind of success level was there? And two, what's the schedule for it coming back?
Yeah, no, it was a great success. We carried over 17,000 people this past summer. Weekends, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We had a bike car. We actually had a bar car, so which was a smashing success. So people could buy, you know, Sam Adams or eat Cape Cod chips or something. It was about a little over 2 hours to and from to get to Hyannis, and it actually made money, taking out the capital costs, which we had in, but just the straight operating costs, it actually made a little money. So
when's it come back?
So we're looking at it. We're talking to Cape Cod Regional Transit Authority, which ran it as well, make sure we can schedule it. But I would tell you, in traffic down the Cape, particularly this summer, the weather was good, the economy's hot. We had a couple of tough weekends down there. Having the Cape Flyer really relieves the pressure. So I know the governor loved it. Really, he pushed us to get it done. So I expect soon we'll make a decision about next summer.
Oh, I'd love to have it back. Love to have it
but
back.
But you didn't go on it, though.
I did not go on it because I was always in a dilemma when I would need my car. What would I do without my car? I should have got a zip car, I guess. But 4th of July weekend down the Cape, I'd never seen anything as bad in my life.
It was
life
a huge backup.
Getting off the Cape. So I regretted not having taken the Cape Flyer.
By the way, anybody online, if you stay on hold, one of our producers will take your phone number.
Yes.
And Rich Davies' office will be in touch. We will forward all emails, and there are a ton of them. Before you go, there's usually something on the immediate horizon you feel that people should know about. Is there such a thing that's imminent?
So there is. You know, we've been working very hard on a capital plan for what we want to do. We've been working with the governor. I expect that the governor is going to be making some announcements real soon about the kind of investments we want to make, particularly over the next 14 months. So I would say stay tuned, but it's certainly going to be focused all over the state. And then for listeners in particular, a number called in about the MBTA in particular, there'll be some, we hope, some big investments in the MBTA very soon. So we have heard people over the last 18 months. We didn't get everything we wanted from the legislature. We're appreciative that they moved the dial, and we're going to make some investments to better the transportation system in this state.
Secretary David, pleasure to see you as
always.
Thank
you.
You're a good sport, Secretary David.
Thank you.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to get a preview of what the Boston Symphony Orchestra is going to sound like under the direction of Andras Nelsons. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Amazon.com. Consumers love it. Shareholders love it. People who work there, they don't always love it.
I mean, he doesn't want it to be, you know, a country club for his employees. He wants everyone given, you know, the proverbial 110%.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the Everything Store and the man who runs it. Next time on Marketplace, it's from APN.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Samets Blackstone Associates for more than 30 years helping businesses and nonprofits tell their stories and build relationships through integrated brand strategy, design, and digital media. On the web at sametz.com. And Nova, making stuff faster. Host David Pogue explores how scientists are pushing the limits of speed in humans and machines. Don't miss an all-new Nova, making stuff faster, Wednesday at 9 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Andrus Nelsons is in town to conduct his first concerts with the Boston Symphony Orchestra since he was named the BSO's music director. Three performances running this Thursday through Saturday. One thing which clearly distinguishes the 34-year-old Nelsons from his predecessors, James Levine, is his youth and energy. Here he is earlier this summer talking to Jared Bowen about the physicality which he brings to his conducting.
It is the music which inspires. I think it's very simple. It's really the music which inspires. Well, I'm quite young. I'm still able to dance on stage. But I think it's the music which inspires that. And also my personal vision or understanding about the conductor. I think the conductor should inspire the orchestra to create the atmosphere of music. So therefore, you should use, of course, your arms, your face, of course, your intellect, but also your body language. In my case, it's probably bigger than smaller, so.
It's bigger than smaller. I love that. Arts reporter Jared Bowen is here with us in Studio 3 to elaborate on Andrus Nelsons and what he brings to the BSO and this week's three performances. Hey, Jared.
Well, it's great to be with you guys.
So let me ask you something. You know, everybody that works at the BSO, the violinists and the percussionists, everybody's an unbelievably talented musician. They wouldn't be there if they weren't. So they all are great at what they do. So why does the conductor matter so much to how great the BSO is or isn't? These people all play beautifully.
Because he's the person who's determining what the sound is. He's the person who's listening and who's going to bring out certain elements. He's the person who's working with the BSO to do the programming, to push them in certain limits, to do programs they may not be comfortable with. It is true. The reason the search took, you know, over 2 years is because it's difficult to find somebody with that sort of intellect and that, frankly, level of genius. And that's why everybody was so excited to have James Levine here, because he is so brilliant in the way that he can look at and interpret music and then pull that sound out of the orchestra. So they need that leader to be able to do that for them. And then now we have this contrast. We go from James Levine, you know, world renowned, to this 34-year-old super energetic young upstart, as he was just talking about. I mean, you physically see him on the stage and how wild he is with waving his hands and the energy to which he approaches the podium.
You know, I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing because Marjorie, the way she asked the question, she once said Keith Lockhart was sitting where you're sitting, Jared. And she said, and I'm paraphrasing, are you really needed in this thing? I mean, couldn't they just play these?
Well, Andrus Nelsons mentions it himself. You want to be the inspiration in some ways. I mean, the music inspires, but you want to be able to inspire your players. But you do wonder that because, like I said, they are all so talented. So this is a dramatic contrast because the previous conductor was much older. And I wonder if that's why they went with someone and he had health problems and issues. Is that why they was 34 on purpose? They want to make sure they get someone that's got some legs in them still, literally?
I think that had a great deal to do with it, frankly. I mean, I think that everybody was so tired by the saga that we went through with James Levine, with all of the health problems and all of the cancellations. And frankly, it got a little bit scary over the course of this summer when suddenly Andrus Nelsons had his own cancellations.
Walks into a door and gets a concussion,
yeah,
right?
Which he has been joking about. I mean, he's somebody who's so affable. This is what I like about him, too. I've interviewed him several times now, and I saw him yesterday at the press conference he gave the first time as music director designate, and he's somebody who doesn't necessarily come with a lot of polish. And I say that in the best possible way, because I think when you get to a certain level, you have your people who surround you, and they control your message, and they control everything that you're saying, and you're very careful about what you're saying. And here, I think we have somebody who's young and fresh, and he's not afraid to admit that he finds this somewhat intimidating, and that he's very, very grateful to be selected to be leading one of the world's greatest orchestras. And he does consider, as many do, the BSO to be one of the world's leading orchestras, and to be in this hall. And so I think that there's sort of – it's like a new coat of paint. It's making everybody happy right now.
Well, not just everybody in the traditional classical music world, I should say. But yeah, first of all, I've started listening to classical music much more since I started working in this building, to be perfectly candid. But I'm excited. As a non-traditional classical music type – reading these interviews, listening to your interviews with them, there's a level of excitement in the lay world, for lack of a better expression, where I belong. It's huge. I want to go see him perform. I want to go see the BSO when it was not at the top of my list. And I assume that's part of the selection process, the excitement, the accessibility, all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. You know, I had a moment yesterday when I was sitting in the Baranek Room, which is where they have all of these great conductors come through. That's where they do their press conferences. I've done any number of big interviews there. And I'm thinking, I'm seeing this man just at the beginning of his career. You really do have the sense that you're thinking to yourself, and I had the same experience. I brought my arts intern with me this summer when I had him with me. And he said to me at the end of the summer, that was the highlight of my summer with you, was being in there doing that interview with Anders Nelsons, because I think everybody has the sense that we are watching this person who's going to be on this meteoric rise, and he's going to be so even more acclaimed someday. And I hate to be the one who's feeding into this balloon that over-expanding everything that he's doing. But I do think that we are in a position now to watch somebody who is just going to have the world captivated someday.
So what is his deal? He's going to be performing for 3 days this week, correct?
Yep.
And then his contract doesn't start till next fall. So how often is he actually going to be here?
Right now, he's the BSO Music Director Designate. So he'll be here in March. He's here now. He'll be here in next March. And then I think we'll see him at Tanglewood again. And then for the 2014 season, he takes over.
Okay.
And he's somebody, and I think right now he's just trying to feel his way. One of the things he stressed yesterday is that he's not going to come in and he's not going to be radical. He wants to, in a very humanistic way, feel out the orchestra. He wants to figure out what their relationship is going to be, find out their strengths, let them get to know him, and that's how he's going to develop. He's not going to suddenly blow out all of the traditional programming and have all of these radical contemporary composers. That is something that he's interested, I think, down the line. But for now, they're just going to build together.
How do they feel about having a kid? I mean, he is a kid.
Yeah.
They're
probably a lot older than a lot of the people.
Exactly. A lot of the players are obviously older than he is.
Well, there was a quite expansive search committee that was part of this, including a number of BSO musicians and players. So they all had a say in who was going to be their leader. And so presumably, they're as enthusiastic as everybody else. And I have to tell you, I'd heard sort of in background conversations, too, that people were relieved. There was a great deal of uncertainty and a time of just sort of waywardness when James Levine was away from the podium so long. So they're just happy to have a leader again.
So are there politics involved when you're the conductor with the orchestra? I mean, he is younger. He'll have different suggestions for what they should be playing, how they should be playing it. Do you have to be like a CEO and schmooze your players, or are they just thrilled if you're a genius and you're eminently talented and they all look good? How does it work?
That's a good question. I don't think that I can necessarily best answer that. Of course, he deals with only the artistic operations. Mark Volpe deals with the business side, the administrative side. But I think that's, in some regard, maybe that's what Anders Nelsons was speaking to yesterday is, in several conversations that I've had with him, he stressed being the kid and stressed being young and feeling young and having a great deal of reverence for the institution, which includes the players who are equally renowned as the legacy of the orchestra itself.
So can I make the exact same point I made a minute ago again, differently? Thank you, Jim. I will. I was trying to think about when I talked about him being accessible and those kind of – when Keith Lockhart is here, One of the reasons I love talking to Keith Lockhart, in addition to the fact that he's a great interview, is it's a guy who seems totally normal with the same taste you have. And then you say, but he's a genius. And so, and the genius is even more appealing because he seems so normal. When you read, Jeff Edgers wrote a couple of pieces about the Globe about Nelson's and says, you know, unlike Levine, who was only into classical music, this guy's into Sting. He's into Michael Jackson. He watches Frasier reruns. You say to yourself, this meaning Nelson's, here's a guy who is sort of like you. I don't mean you, Jared, like all of us. He's like a normal human being who's a genius, which to me makes it a much more intriguing tale than someone, I don't mean to disparage Levine at all, but who is sort of a distant figure. Do you understand where I'm coming from?
I do. There's nothing lofty. First of all, yes, Keith Lockhart is so much like me that we buy our pants at the same place.
That is not true.
We discovered that at Tanglewood.
Where would that be, please?
I can't tell you. You'll have to. I'll tell you off.
Oof! I can't wait.
Secret pants place. Wow.
We're also the same size, maybe not the same length, but the same size. But no, and that was another thing I was thinking about Andrus Nelson's yesterday, and again having had these conversations that he is a real person and he wants to settle into the city. He wants to be a fixture. I think he recognizes the importance of community. He stresses the importance of music and community. He frequently talks about how music needs to feed your soul and nurture you. And I think he knows that the only way he can do that is by settling down here. I mean, he's not going to live here permanently. He has engagements all over the world, but he plans to have an apartment here in Boston. He plans to go to sporting events. He loves hockey. And as you mentioned, he loves popular culture. He loves the television shows. He doesn't have a lot of downtime, but those are the things he loves to do and is looking forward to when he comes here.
One last question for me, Jared Bowen. Who is the audience of the BSO now?
The audience is older. The audience is, I think, typical of what you'd expect, and I think that's beginning to change. I know that the Symphony, like a number of other arts organizations, is creating a number of events for younger people.
So you're older when you say like over 50, or are you talking about like 75?
I think it's typically over 50.
Yeah.
But I'm encouraged. Every time I go, I seem to see more younger people who are embracing the BSO, and I think this is going to change a lot too.
I can't wait to meet this guy, actually. I am really excited.
He's
a big opera singer.
Yeah, his wife is a big opera singer, as Jim just said. I mean, that's what a family.
It's an extraordinary family, and he's the son of a cellist, and I believe a cellist, and his mother founded an opera company.
They have a toddler with a little teeny tiny violin. Yeah.
Okay, so Jared, while Andrus Nelson's is, I don't know if he's a nervous kind of guy, is nervously preparing for his third of three concerts on Saturday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, you'll be preparing for something else. Actually, you'll be conducting your own thing. You're hosting one of the many sessions at the Boston Book Festival Saturday in the 5 o'clock range. What are you doing and who are you doing with?
Well, first of all, I have to say I love the Boston Book Festival. It's one of the great events in this city, and I'm thrilled to be back this year. And I have the very intimidating task of interviewing Jack Gray, who's a producer for Anderson Cooper. You know, he was just a peon producer here at New England Cable News way back when.
Yeah, I heard good things about him.
And then he rocketed forward and
has now
written this book, Pigeon in a Crosswalk, all about his working for Anderson Cooper and palling around with all these celebrities, and I have to interview him.
You know what's incredible? Talk about coincidence. This is a total coincidence. You know who happens to be on the phone at this very moment?
I have no idea.
The very same author of Pigeon in a Crosswalk, who used to be a producer at NECN, but then, what'd you say, exploded onto the national scene. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, the author of Pigeon in a Crosswalk, Jack Ray. Hey, Jack.
Good morning, Mr. Browdy, or good afternoon. Marjorie, you'll be the only one I'll be addressing during this segment.
Really?
Did I just hear Jim a few minutes ago refer to himself as a normal person? Because that was a good one. As we know, Marjorie, he's a lot of things. Normal is not even here on the list.
You are correct, Jack Gray. That is absolutely true. But I have to ask you a question, because you did work at NECN for quite some time, along with Jim Browdy, who was
the producer of one of my shows for a while.
Exactly.
Marjorie,
the producer of one of his
Wired,
shows.
Yes. Wired, yes. Tens of viewers.
And you wrote... Yes. You wrote this very clever book, as Jared just mentioned, Pigeons in a Crosswalk, and I read it and I chuckled and it was terrific. However, I did note that in all those pages, all those chapters, there was no mention of Jim Browdy. How'd that happen?
How did that happen, Jack Gray?
Well, first of all, I never interacted with him much because he was too busy in the makeup room crying most of the time when I worked at NECN. But we had a famously short-lived show, Wired, which still haunts me to this day. But we had lots of fun. No, you know, Jim is just, I was too worried about him having a bad reaction. I think I focused a lot on Chet in the book. You know,
yeah. Brilliantly, Chet Curtis.
Yeah.
The great Chet Curtis.
Browdy was just too much of a wild card. I didn't know when he would show up at my apartment, you know, threatening down my door.
That's a good reason, Jack.
I'm looking forward to the book festival this Saturday at 5:15 with Jared Bowen, who I love how he was casually name-dropping by in his same pants. I was going to let that slide. This is a very relatable discussion, the segment. Browdy, so normal, Jared and Keith Lockhart in their pants. And wait, Jared, I have to ask you, does Joan Kennedy still go to the BSO? Because you know I love me some Joan Kennedy, and I wrote about her in my book.
Actually, Jack, every time I go to the BSO, I see Joan Kennedy.
I am told she buys her pants at the exact same. Hey, Jared and Jack. Well, Jared, you can. Where in at 5:15 on Saturday, you and Jack Gray, where are you? How do people get tickets? What's the deal?
I think you could just show up. I mean, lines.
Yeah, free to attend.
Lines
yeah.
form early. Jack, you can. I know you're going to tell me where to go because I'm so
where
disorganized.
Is it, Jack?
Well, first of all, if Jared promises to show up even half sober, it'll be very appreciated.
Really?
It's at the Boston Common.
It's 5 o'clock, Jack. I make no promises.
Center. Wait, where is it again?
The Boston Common Hotel and Conference Center, which I believe is at 40 Trinity Place near mm-hmm. Copley Square. It's free, no tickets required. 5:15 to 6:15, there'll be books for sale, and you know, afterwards, and it'll be fun. It'll be great. If, you know, Jared can bring Joan Kennedy, that would be even better. But, you know,
well, I'm stopping by. Hey, and Jack, before you go, I have to say, your new show, the Anderson Cooper 10 o'clock show, one of the best shows on television. It is spectacular.
Thank you both.
Congratulations to you and Anderson Cooper. Jack, it's a pleasure. We'll see you Saturday night, 5 o'clock, wherever you said.
And congratulations on a terrific book. You did a great job.
Great.
Thanks. Three of my favorite people. Talk to you guys soon.
Take care. Jack Gray, Saturday night, 5 o'clock, Pigeon in a Crosswalk, being interviewed by his buddy and ours, Jared Bowen. Jared, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, guys.
Talk to you later. You all know Jack Gray with Anderson Cooper. He's a producer, and Jared Bowen, of course, is an arts reporter and a host of the TV show Open Studio. Both of you guys, thank you very much for being here. When we come back, it's time for Open Mic with the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Six months after the Boston Marathon bombings, WGBH News goes back to the intersection of Dexter and Laurel Streets in Watertown.
You heard about the officer that was shot in the leg. He was right over there.
And here's from the owner of the gym where Tamerlan Tsarnaev worked out.
I will fight your enemies to my last breath and see them dead. Like, that's what came out of his mouth.
I'm Philip Martin. Join us for a focus on the Boston Marathon bombings 6 months later. This week on WGBH Radio, WGBH2, and WGBHnews.org.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Dover Rug and Home. Rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's new showroom in Natick, featuring a squash club, or doverrug.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. He joins us every Wednesday on Open Mic. He's the editor of the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Brian McGrory.
Hello, Jim Browdy. How are you?
Hey, Brian.
Hey, Marjorie.
Hi there.
I'm great. Jim's great.
I'm
We're all
good.
Great. We're all great. So, Brian, I've been dying to ask you this. A Boston Globe WBZ debate kicks off last night at 7 o'clock. Just assume we're in the last two innings of a 1-0 Red Sox playoff game. What is the editor of the Boston Globe and a lifelong Sox fan to do?
Well, I'll tell you what the editor is to do. The editor sticks to the baseball game for the last couple of innings.
Truth will set you free,
I
Brian.
I love it. You are an honest man.
Now, let me clarify. I went back and forth. Because everybody went back and forth. I mean, what are you supposed to do here? It was an unfortunate situation.
It was an unfortunate situation.
Well, maybe it was a 1-0 thing. If they'd been ahead 6-0, maybe you could have stayed with the debate longer, Brian, perhaps?
Look, the owner of the Red Sox is about to be our owner in a week.
That's a good point.
Fine watching the baseball game.
That's a great point. I should have thought of that myself. Okay.
Thank you.
So, you know, your headline in the Globe was that the guys had much in common. John Conley and Marty Walsh are both running for mayor of Boston. We had in the Herald the gloves down and a punchless debate. The conventional wisdom seems to be they didn't show much difference between them, each other, whatever I'm trying to say here.
We know what you're saying.
I thought they did, but what do you think?
I agree with you, Marjorie. I don't buy into the convention on this one. I think in content they seemed relatively similar, although, you know, obviously you had John Conley stressing his education background. And you had Marty Walsh stressing his life story. I thought the real difference was in style, and I thought they were very different then. And for many voters in Boston, this was their first introduction to these two guys, watching them side by side for the first time. And what they saw were, stylistically, two very different candidates.
Competent, but stylistically different. I would say the one substantive difference I thought was quite huge, and you never know if this is what people in our business pick up on or the average voter picks up on. I thought the whole back and forth about binding arbitration, the bill that Marty Walsh filed on Beacon Hill, and the fact that Connolly went back to it 4, maybe 5 times was a pretty dramatic back and forth. And I think that stays with people. Does that stay with real people, particularly when Connolly put a price tag on it? I don't know if it's legit or not, this $200 million price tag. Does that stay with people?
I mean, I'm not. It's a good point, Jim. I'm not entirely sure if it does or doesn't. Maybe their eyes glaze over it. You know, the constant back and forth on the issue, or maybe in glossier ways, they just say, Marty Walsh is a Labor candidate. I'm not sure I can trust him with something like this. Or maybe they do what Marty Walsh is pushing them to do, and that is say, here's a guy who's so familiar with labor that he can actually resolve these contracts before they get to the panic stage. I honestly don't know. I mean, we'll find out soon enough on this.
Do you think Menino can really sit this out for, 20 more days? He continues to say things like, as long as they're not bashing Boston, I'll stay out of this. But this is this guy's life. 20 years. Apparently, he's not crazy about either of them. But still, he's got to be more crazy about one than he is the other. Do you find it plausible that he sits this out till November 5th?
I do. I honestly do, yes, because for a couple of reasons. One is in this campaign, he's coming across looking good. These two candidates do not want to alienate him for two reasons. One, they don't want him coming out in favor of the other candidate. And two, they know that Menino is so popular with voters that they risk alienating voters by talking bad about the mayor. And as you pointed out, Jim, he has no great affection for either of these guys. So it's not like he's being drawn to support one of them over the other. It's kind of a classic Boston moment. The only way he would go to one candidate or the other is that if he find somebody he dislikes less.
We're talking with Brian McGroy, who's editor of the Boston Globe, about the mayoral debate last night, sponsored by BZ and the Globe. We're doing one on Tuesday. I'm already getting nervous. But anyway,
we should say GBH Radio on TV doing it next Tuesday, and we happen to be the moderators.
Yes.
Are you really the moderators? Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on.
We are the moderators. That is correct. That is correct.
You really the editor of the Boston Globe?
All I think when we had these conversations, remember that great line? Who was the guy that ran with Ross Perot? General Stockdale, whatever his name was.
Yeah, General Stockdale. Admiral
run,
Stockdale.
Admiral in the middle of the debate. Remember this, Brian? He says, "Who am I and why am I here?" I mean, don't you have those moments every once in a while?
Marjorie, if you're co-moderating with Jim, you won't have to say a word. You know,
I know, that's the beauty of it.
Sit there and look as great as you
that's
always
right.
do. Jim will handle everything else.
He will. He will handle everything else. Maybe I'll get one question out of 25. But anyway, you know, I thought Joan Vernocchi had a great point in your paper this morning when she talked about the candidate's life story. I mean, Marty Walsh does have, and it was almost Menino-like, even though Menino didn't have these problems, but the recovering from cancer as a kid, being a recovering alcoholic, alcoholic. Lots
Those were the
of
first
people,
words out of his mouth,
yes,
by the way, last night.
Lots of people are recovering alcoholics, or they've had drug problems. You know, you've got that whole big community. I don't know how big it is, but it's significant. So you have an overcome the obstacle kind of guy who was much, for my money, more rough around the edges last night than John Conley, who seems, on the surface at least, to have had a more or less rocky life, put it that way. I mean, you know what I'm saying? And that is effective with some people.
I think it is, and I know you're about to mention it, Marjorie, but we had a very good front-page story on Sunday about the recovery community coming out in favor of Marty Walsh. Very compelling. Evidently, he picks up the phone constantly, calls people who are part of that community, gives them encouragement at times of need, and really, you know, makes a point of being constantly available and reaching out. And it is compelling. It is compelling. And I'm not sure yet how that will play with voters. The one thing I would say about last night is, and I thought it really stuck out, does neither of these guys have an ounce of humor in them?
Amen. I am so with you. And people would remember it. You were so right.
I mean, it was as earnest and dry a performance on both their parts as you could possibly have. I mean, crack a smile and maybe even a joke, and the whole thing might have been a little more enjoyable.
I think it's nerves, though. I heard, I believe it was Conley said he was quite nervous. I heard Walsh say, this is in a post-debate interview, I think on BZ, that he had never done a one-on-one debate,
right,
particularly one-on-one debate, maybe one-on-one debate, which had been televised. So I think you may attribute it to nerves. So maybe next week, I don't know if we told you, we're moderating the second debate here at WGBH.
Yes, we are.
Let me write this down so I remember. So you're moderating the
Jimmy,
debate.
That's
the two
right.
of us are, yes.
I'm going to be the assistant, I guess, is what you're saying, Brian, is what you expect. But one last thing about the debate. You know, if I were John Conley, I would hammer home this whole thing with Marty Walsh being close to the unions because of how it affects the schools, because of how it affects trash pickup. If you're awarding these huge raises to municipal unions, you can't afford these other things that you want to do in the city.
A lot of union families in Boston, Marjorie, and they vote.
Well, but there's a lot of the union families in the police department are not in Boston. I mean, there's exceptions to who has to live in Boston, and a lot of people that work for the city are grandfathered out. Correct me if I'm wrong, Brian McGraw, you know this, that they don't have to live in the city, and they don't live in the city. They live
elsewhere. No, I think
elsewhere.
You're, look at it, I'm going to be diplomatic here. I think you're both right, and I think that these candidates are trying to figure out how labor is going to play in this race, because it is a huge, huge issue. And I honestly don't think we're going to know until Election Day which way it breaks.
Brian, we've discussed almost every week you've been with us yet another installment in your Broken City series about this total dysfunction, particularly today we can focus on it, in Washington. The most recent was, while everybody's focusing on the Tea Party caucus, Speaker Boehner's unwillingness to rein them in, at least as of the moment, your piece focused, Matt Visor's piece focused on the disengagement of Barack Obama. What was it, a year and a half before he was there, before he had sat down with John Boehner one-on-one? Was only it, two sit-downs, one-on-one. What did I get that wrong?
Well, it was between the first meeting and the
second meeting.
It was a year and a half.
Only two sit-downs ever, apparently one-on-one with Mitch McConnell, Republican leader. So regardless of what the outcome is, whether they fix it today or they fix it in a couple of days, does anything ever come of this? Is there an electoral revolution? Is there a reform? Or do we just write this off to this is the way Washington is? And you had a great series. We had a horrible couple of years in terms of legislative and governmental dysfunction. And it just goes into the woodwork. What happens?
Well, first of all, thank you, Jim, for bringing up the series again.
It's great.
I thought Matt Visor's story was somewhat counterintuitive and pretty terrific,
mm-hmm.
Pointing out the president's role in this, which is not inconsequential. You know, even if you go back to Bill Clinton and his ability to engage Newt Gingrich for good or bad, it meant a lot. And the total lack of engagement now is pretty troubling. We're now going to turn the series, we've got one more part to go on pointing out the problems, and then we're going to point the series toward possible solutions and where bipartisanship is done well, how it's done well, what people are saying can be done to resolve some of these problems. So that'll be coming up in the next month or so. Look, you know this, so much of Washington runs in cycles, and when you're in one of these down cycles, you think it's never going to resolve itself. These things usually take care of themselves, and it usually happens at the ballot box. People just get sick of the drivel that's coming out of there, and they start tossing the elected officials out who are causing it. So, I mean, I'm hopeful that democracy prevails again and that we get more moderate voices in Washington who can actually solve problems rather than cause them.
But you know what scares me about that, Brian, is that when you read about the redistricting in some of these radical Republicans' home districts, you wonder if they're ever going to get voted out because they seem to be doing the bidding of the people that elected them. So
by the way, on both sides of the aisle, while the Tea Party caucus is the biggest problem here, there are also districts we've discussed even in Massachusetts, Barney Frank's old district. There's a lot of gerrymandering on the Democratic side, too.
Yeah, and I know there's more independents than Democrats, but we mostly vote Democratic in Massachusetts with some exceptions. But I guess that's the part that scares me, is that there are these pockets of real right radicalism that aren't going to go away.
They are definitely there. And we, you know, one part of the Broken City series was talking about how these districts are gerrymandered. Another part, it was a Matt Visor story, went out to, what's this ref's name? Is it Huelskamp?
Is that the Minnesota guy who served decades ago and then came back?
No, that's another guy. Uh-huh. This was a guy in Kansas who Matt went out, talked to people in his district who just said, yeah, we basically want him to shut down the government.
Yeah.
You know, we're fully supportive of him, you know, doing whatever it takes. And this was many months ago that we were out there talking to them. So to Marjorie's point, they're actually, a lot of these voters are getting the result they want. And, you know, this was the reason they elected some of these guys. So that is a little scary. I still think that when people see the ramifications of the shutdown fully, and especially not resolving the debt limit. I mean, come on, moderate voices have to prevail here.
Yeah, but we were discussing exactly that with Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School yesterday. One of the things where places where the president has failed, at least I think in my estimation, and I believe Marjorie agrees, is he's explained quite well the big picture, the economy, the international impacts, etc. Do you think the average man and woman in Boston or greater Boston has any idea what a default means in their life?
No.
Is, why would you take vengeance out on anybody in office if you don't understand what the implications are for you?
Well, you will understand it when it happens.
Yes.
And when the stock market tumbles,
exactly.
People's 401k plans go from, you know, go down by 40%. People will understand very vividly what it means. And look at part of the reason people may not understand it now may be the fault of you and me that we haven't used our various platforms to get the word out there.
Well, I think we have. I mean, there's been a lot of writing and a lot of talking and a lot of television stuff about the stock market taking more dips, people losing their confidence. There was a
hypothetical, though, still, until it happens, it's hypothetical. It hasn't happened. I mean, it's gone up. It went down and then it went up again the next day. So I agree with Brian. If it happens, which I think most of us hope it does not, then you feel the impact.
I think there's been some pretty big dips. And I think that,
but there have been some pretty big rises right after the dips.
Late last week, when they thought there was
going to be a deal.
Yeah, and back down again because we're depressed about it.
Can I just say, you guys sound like you've been married for about 40 years.
Whatever. we're preparing for next Tuesday's debate, Brian.
That's right.
Oh, my God.
Let's move on.
The debate is going to be so wonderful if this gets like this.
Yeah, it's next Tuesday we're doing a debate here, GBH.
We're going to be sitting down. I think that's a crucial factor.
I didn't tell you I'm going to be standing. You were sitting down.
Oh, okay. Now, I'm going to have to shout in my questions from the corner of the room, Brian.
Brian, that's a serious topic. We've discussed this with you almost every week, but there's a new installment today by Wesley Lowery in your paper. We had Martha Coakley, the Attorney General, in here the other day and talked to her about why she chose to reject the call of the Civil Liberties Union to do an investigation of the shooting of the man, Ibrahim Todashev, in Orlando, who was allegedly, by an FBI agent purportedly, who was allegedly about to sign a confession saying that he and the elder Tsarnaev brother were responsible for the triple murder in Waltham on 9/11 of 2011. The FBI has given virtually nothing out. We know that the FBI clears itself in all these cases. Why didn't you do anything, Martha Coakley, we asked. She said, I don't have the power. Harvey Silverglate, civil liberties lawyer, was with us yesterday, says, in fact, she does have the power. Well, the latest installment in this is your paper reports this morning that the girlfriend of Ibrahim Todashev, who one would think we would want as much information as long as we could possibly get information from, was deported by ICE, the Immigration and whatever, I forget what the acronym stands for now, and Custom Enforcement or whatever it is, deported. What does that say to you? What it says to me, I'll say, is that the desire was to get anybody who knows anything about this as quickly out of the country as is possible. What other conclusion can one draw?
I mean, I would tend to agree with that, and the whole thing is utterly crazy. The lack of information, when we do get information, what it is we're learning, and the deportation is just kind of stunning here. That said, if they really wanted her to be silent, would they really have sent her to a back home where they would have no control over it all?
You mean as opposed to keeping her in jail here?
Yes.
Maybe.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But it's every single act here, it seems to me, is an endless succession of efforts to make sure the public knows as little as possible. And again, I'll say it for the 4,000th time, and my apologies for being repetitive. If it turns out that he was really about to sign that confession, and then one connects the dots and suggests that maybe law enforcement should have been able to detect that Todashev and the older Tsarnaev were responsible for those killings. And if they were apprehended prior to April 15th of this year, there would not have been a marathon bombing. That's speculative. I have no idea if that's what the outcome would have been. But there are a million questions that people in this region are entitled to answers to.
Yeah, I mean, Jim, you're connecting a lot of dots.
I am, I know.
You're connecting a lot of dots, but there, you know, there are questions that are worth asking. And the frustrating part is we are getting utterly no response from the federal government at a time when we absolutely should be getting a response, and it's really frustrating.
And that's why, at least I think I speak for Marjorie and me both. And if I don't, Marjorie would disagree. That's why we would hope,
Jim, you can speak for me,
that Martha Coakley would find some way to figure out how, since we had two people on the taxpayers' dime from Massachusetts in that apartment, at least at some point, even if not at the shooting time, we don't know, that we would conduct our own investigation.
Well, this could become an issue in the gubernatorial debate, too, depending on how things go with Martha Coakley and winning the Democratic nomination or not. Anyway, Brian, I want to ask you, you know, because I miss your column a lot in the Globe, and I remember reading columns where you'd be sitting over a nice Merlot and a little tenderloin at the Capitol Grill with Rudy Giuliani, or maybe you'd be there at the Grill 23 with George Bush and having a nice
little
scallop drizzled
with
hazelnut sauce. But I don't recall you ever sitting with, like, the Saugus Selectman at the Hilltop Steakhouse.
Did I
miss that?
So here's, but Jim, could you lose the gleeful tone?
Hilltop's closing, by the way, for people who
don't
know that.
Having grown up on the South Shore, a trip to Saugus was basically the equivalent of getting on a plane and flying to France. You just didn't go to Route 1 when you're down in Weymouth. It just didn't happen. Although eventually, if you'll recall, the old Valley Steakhouse in Braintree became a Hilltop for a while.
Right, it did.
And I will confess, I never darkened the doors to the Hilltop Steakhouse. I'm really embarrassed about this. I've never had a Hilltop steak. What do you want me to say here?
That's okay. I don't think I ever had a steak there. I might have had the chopped sirloin with the mushroom sauce once.
Why didn't you?
25 years ago.
Why didn't you? Since it was this iconic, a grossly overused word, but why didn't you darken its doorstep?
Because you have to wait in a long, long line to get in. Mm-hmm. It's the steak was always supposed to be, you know, it was good steak, but once I learned I could build a globe for my meals out, I wasn't going to drive up to Saugus.
Okay, on that note...
I have a question. Could you add the glasses of Merlot on the expenses, or did you have to pay those out of pocket?
Why don't we leave that one alone?
I think you should leave it. Hey, before you go, speaking of the globe,
just wondering how it works over there on the boulevard.
By mentioning the fact that the soon-to-be owner of the Boston Globe is also happens to be the owner of the Boston Red Sox, who won a spectacular game yesterday. What is the... You told us a week or two or three ago that your sense was this deal would be closed sometime in October. Is that still what you're
it
saying?
Is. I would look to... I think people are looking to see this happen within a week. So I think within a week. We should have a deal. Yeah.
Hey, in all seriousness, please feel free to tell your new boss we'd love to have him on the show once he is the owner of the Boston Globe.
I will. I will relay that. Hopefully, he wasn't listening to this part today about me building my stakes. I'm surprised you didn't bring up the Stan Grossfeld photo. Where are you?
It is.
For God's sakes, how do you not bring that up?
That you should talk. It is one of the classics of
all time. Okay, tell people.
Go ahead.
Tell people.
I mean, Stan, who's a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning Globe photographer, been here for the longer part of forever, and thank God he has been, traveled the world shooting amazing images, was at the game on Sunday night, and was up in a place he wasn't supposed to be, up on the in the second level on the first base line, and had this huge lens on his camera. And as the ball was traveling off out of the park, off David Ortiz's bat, he just started shooting away. And wouldn't you know it, he grabbed the iconic shot. Sorry to use that word, Jim, with Torrey Hunter's legs up in a perfect V, and that cop
Horgan.
With his arms raised in another V, and it is the image that has gone around the world.
It's great. The W.
It will be as classic here as Bobby Orr flying through the air.
He's a great photographer. You ever take a ride in Stan Grossfeld's car?
I have not. No. Should I avoid that? Or
Well, I just remember he's a great guy. I remember going someplace with him somewhere, and I think it took us several hours to clear out a space for me to get in and sit down next to him.
I can relate to that.
He's a great guy. He's a grizzled news guy with an unbelievably creative flair.
And he's great.
Just a great guy.
But he's a great writer, too. He's written some great stories to accompany his photos.
Yes.
And, his
parts. Yes.
And he did that whole book about Fenway Park with Dan Shaughnessy.
Yes.
Hey, before you go away, though, I wasn't going to bring this up, but since you brought up the great photo, and it is a great photo, which everybody has seen, a lot of people were reported to have left Fenway before Ortiz hit the grand slam. I think it was in the eighth inning. I'm not sure, because they thought it was a lost cause. It was 5-0 or whatever. Were you among them?
That is such a cheap way of asking if I was at the game.
No, that was part,
getting me to say whether I left or not.
Were you at the game?
I did not leave Fenway before the end of the game.
Okay, fine.
I thought Stan Grossfeld had a picture of you in the parking lot. That we're about.
Hugging Officer Horgan. Brian McGrory, great to talk to you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you, guys, and good luck Tuesday.
Thank you very much. Brian McGrory is the editor of the Boston Globe. He is with us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Christopher Lydon at 1 o'clock. And if you missed last night's first mayoral debate between John Conley and Marty Walsh, Peter Kazis and David Bernstein will bring you the abridged version. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This week on Innovation Hub, author Douglas Rushkoff sees a future where we spend more of our time creating something of value for each other instead of punching the clock.
So if you only have to work, 10 or 20% of what you used to work, then the fact that there's no jobs stops looking quite as daunting as it did.
I'm Kara Miller. A look into the economy of the future, Thursday night at 9 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and four centuries of Massachusetts furniture, where you can see extraordinary furniture made in Massachusetts from the 1600s to the present at museums and cultural institutions throughout the state. Details at fourcenturies.org. And Commonwealth School, an independent co-ed high school in Boston, cultivating intellectual passion, leadership, and connection with the city and the world. Open house Sunday, October 20th from 3 to 5 p.m. commschool.org.
This is Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marty Regan. Last night, I hope you know, was the first mayoral debate between Marty Walsh and John Connolly. Joining us to go over what we learned about these two candidates and how they might differ as the next mayor of Boston are GBH political analysts Peter Kazis and Dave Bernstein. David is also a contributing editor of Boston Magazine. Gentlemen, good to see you.
Great to be here.
Thanks, you guys. So since I already talked to Peter Kazis this morning, let me start with you.
But not everybody was privy to that conversation.
That's right. But I'm wondering what you thought. Was there a winner last night? Were voters moved in either direction?
Well, that would assume that any voters saw the debate. I think that this was, as I wrote today, was sort of a warm-up, kind of a spring training debate. Well, that they got to, neither of them have done any kind of high-stakes, televised live debate like this. This is a really first for both of them. I think they both, had to sort of work out some jitters and some kinks. And fortunately, they got to do it, while everyone was watching the Red Sox game. So it was kind of a free pass for them.
Connolly actually said, Dan Ray, in a post-debate interview last night, that he was nervous before the debate. And Walsh said what you said, that I hadn't done something like this before. So they did have jitters.
Yeah. And it's a very difficult thing to do if you haven't done it before, to try to be, and you could kind of tell, I think, that they were both sort of inside their head a little bit, trying to go through, okay, how am I supposed to be coming off? John Connolly clearly has been told you need to be likable, and he was trying to figure out what that means.
Right.
And Marty clearly was trying to not he was trying to be as close as possible to John Connolly, I think, on the issues, because he wants the differentiator in the race to not be policy, which is sort of John Connolly's stronger suit. He wants it to be more about background and, you know, I'm the sort of guy who understands what you go through as your family and that kind of thing. So, so I thought that they both had their moments. I don't think there was anything, you know, big either way, except that I think that this is Peter's observation, too, that Marty Walsh really needs to find a way to handle the whole arbitration and labor thing, which he didn't last night.
Let's get to the arbitration thing in a minute, because I think that was the one set of dramatic moments in the debate. But since you mentioned David Bernstein, Marty Walsh trying to separate them on their personal stories, here's just a little tidbit of what Walsh said right out of the box.
I grew up in Dorchester. As a young kid, I overcame cancer. As a young adult, I overcame alcoholism. It's kind of shaped me who I am today.
I wasn't surprised that he brought it out, because he sort of outed himself in a column about his alcoholism with Yvonne Abraham a few months ago in the Boston Globe. But literally seconds into the debate last night, Peter Kadzis, he put those things on the table. That surprise you at all?
It did a little bit. Actually, more than a little bit. It probably shouldn't. I mean, I guess we're such a therapeutic society. When I read that Yvonne Abraham column, you know, early in the race, I thought, good for him. Get this out there. You know, there's a good story, and this is something that people will keep in the back of their mind and use to evaluate him. I'm surprised at how much, you know, psycho feeling there is in the Walsh campaign.
It's not the Dorchester Irish Catholic of old.
It's not the Dorchester I grew up with. And if there are any doubters, that was St. Gregory's Parish.
Yeah, you know. Not the tough guy sort of thing. But you know,
and by the way, just real
quickly, I had glasses, so I had to run fast.
He brought all that up in direct response to a question of how are you different from your opponent. So I don't think it's an accident. And he did it again at the end when Keller asked the question again. It's definitely meant to point out, to be a way of saying, without saying it, John Connolly is a guy of privilege. He got his political connections through his father. He got to go to Harvard.
Who was the former Secretary of State for
Right, but let me point something out there. You know, Marty Walsh, too, benefited in a different way, but he benefited from his family background. I mean, his father was a laborer, yes, but his father also got him into the union. Mm-hmm. And that union paid him, what, $170,000, $180,000 a year? So, you know, to me, these are flip sides of the same coin. You know, these are both Dorchester boys, Dorchester men. It's spooky that I'm older than the guys running for mayor. But these are, you know, these are Boston men who represent flip sides, but of the same coin. One is white collar, one is blue collar. But they both have an element of privilege.
You know, this whole thing about the arbitration and Marty Walsh's being defined as a union guy as opposed to John Connolly, who's the school guy, I did not know until this debate. We already knew that Marty Walsh had proposed legislation up on Beacon Hill as a state representative that would have prevented the city council in Boston from stepping in and rejecting these arbitration awards. We have a big arbitration award now from one of the patrolman unions that would cost $80 million, I think, if it went through. I did not know that Marty Walsh also proposed a bill when he was up at Beacon Hill that would have really made it impossible for Speaker of the House Bob DeLeo to do his reforms on health care. A lot of the municipalities have much more generous health care benefits, much more expensive to the taxpayers than the state. So he's got two whammies against him if you are a voter that's concerned about the city of Boston having to pay these.
Or two assets if you're from a family that is either has union background or
you would like to raise that. Okay, you get two whammies against you if you're from the taxpayer perspective, two pluses if you are with the municipal union person.
I find it very interesting. And it's perhaps unavoidable, though, that the blue-collar union people in Boston, the carpenters, the electricians, the masons, the hospital workers, their benefits, as solid as they might be, are nowhere near as good as the other union members, the public employee unions.
Right.
You know, public employee unions are much more privileged than trade unions. I just find it interesting that everyone says, you know, talks about unions as a group when there are differentiations.
You know, you mentioned the arbitration thing, and that was the one point last night, at least in my estimation, and I think yours, David and Peter, where there was dramatic tension between the two candidates. And John Connolly didn't press the issue once. He did it repeatedly about halfway through the debate. It was almost like he was lying in wait. Let's work backwards. Here late in the debate is Connolly raising it for the third, fourth, or fifth time with an abrupt answer from Marty Walsh.
I'm just concerned that when your campaign is taking over $1 million in outside money, and when you also work in two roles for these unions, that will influence what you do when you're mayor. And we've seen that it certainly influences the legislation that you filed.
No comment.
Okay.
No comment. But earlier, and maybe it's because he had a comment three or four times, here's one of Marty Walsh's earlier responses to that line of attack.
What my bill did for binding arbitration actually made that last resort going to the end. We need to be able to work these contracts out, and I, as mayor, will work these contracts out, whether it's a police contract, fire contract, pension contract, retiree contract, or healthcare contract. I have those relationships that I'll be able to come up with a good, solid plan for the city of Boston.
We're with David Bernstein and Peter Kadzis. So, David, starting with you, I have a really hard time. As a former union president myself, as somebody who's intimately on top of this, I like to think, how does that play with an average person in Boston who's just a typical middle-income family member? Do they say, yeah, great, he's a union guy, he's going to be able to work with other union men and women, or is he a captive of those people?
Well, it's sort of an existential campaign problem for Marty Walsh, and has been from the beginning. And I think that one of the problems that the campaign faces and that he faces now is that instead of just fully embracing it and saying, I'm a labor guy, that's what I've always been, that's what you're going to find in my legislation, he's tried to make this distinction of, I'm a labor guy, but, you know, and that's gotten him now in all kinds of trouble, including trying to make these just untenable cases about what his bills actually do, you know, and trying to say that they're not really pro-labor things. And the danger that he faces that I think is starting to come up is not just this reinforcing of him as the labor guy and will he do – and by the way, he for some reason voluntarily brought up in part of that discussion that he negotiated against the city for the as in his role with the labor council, you know, which was kind of a gift, you know, in that sense. But he risks his credibility. He has this authenticity as part of his brand. You know, John Connolly, you can't necessarily trust. He might be talking out of, you know, he's a politician, might be talking out of both sides of his mouth. But I'm turning for a regular guy. I'm your next door neighbor. But, you know, you look at that Yvonne Abraham column of a couple of weeks ago about this issue where she basically says, like, you know, I tried to talk to him about this arbitration bill, and I just cannot believe what he's telling me.
You know, let's make a big comparison. I just finished Chris Matthews' book about Reagan.
We had him here
Tip
last
O'Neill.
Week. It was great.
Yeah. Tip O'Neill was who he was, and when he was accused of being a tax and spend liberal, he said, you bet, I am. And, you know, it's a little unfair because we're talking, you know, the summit, the major leagues of national politics. But there's a lesson in there. I mean, there's a lesson in
there. Well, I think being Boston mayor is a summit. I mean, it's no small fry kind of position either.
Filling Menino's shoes, I got to say, you could tell, and my sympathy was with these guys. I think we all know this, that, boy, this really was their first time head-to-head. And you do realize, and I've been taking pot shots at Mayor Menino for 20 years, but you realize this guy is a pro.
Oh, yeah.
Menino.
Yes.
Yeah.
Menino.
Okay. So, you know, we talked about this too this morning. The whole thing of John Connolly's emphasizing education, emphasizing that he's a teacher. But mostly he's been a lawyer. So he's vulnerable on that a little bit too. Is he not, Peter Kadzis?
The teacher claim, I think, is a bridge too far. I mean, I think he's pushed it too far.
What was it, 2 years, 3 years maybe?
2 years and with a year as a volunteer.
And there's a Jesuit prep school. Nativity Prep is a Jesuit school, right?
Well, that counts. You're allowed. That counts. Yeah, he's still teaching.
But it's not a Boston public school.
I think, his claim is his entire time on the city council has been focused on education, more than being a lawyer. But by the way, I think those are points we're going to hear when you two get these guys on stage
maybe
next Tuesday.
We'll see. So
oh, Jim, you're so coy.
Okay, so there are two televised debates left. There's the consortium.
You're going to talk all policy, right?
Two weeks from now, there's the debate, as you mentioned, Marjorie and I are doing GBH radio and TV. 6 days from now. Did last night change the, assuming either people saw a piece of it, taped a piece of it, read the news accounts or listening to you, did it change anybody's mind?
I doubt it. I don't know that it got, that it did enough, that either of them did. I think they both looked, mayoral, for the most part, but neither of them really got, by the way, on the attorney thing, just to make the point, Michael Flaherty was a lawyer. That was his main job. But right. Sam Yoon was a lawyer. There was always a little looking into it. I'm sure there'll be some looking into John Connolly's. But, it's not, I'm not trying to, say it shouldn't be looked into or anything. I agree with Peter that when he, calls himself a teacher, that's too far. He's good when he says, I spent a couple of years in the classroom and I learned a little bit. I took something
from that. Had a profound impact on me. Okay, yeah, so instead of giving advice to me and Marjorie, we have 6 days to get advice from both of you prior to the debate. Give advice to the candidates. At some point, they want to distinguish themselves from each other. The polls show 7 or 8 point split. Most people think it's going to be a margin of error race. So, Peter Kadzis, you're sitting down with Marty Walsh one-on-one or John Connolly this afternoon, having watched the debate. Here's what I think you should do for the final 20 days of the campaign to win this. What do you say to both of them?
I would say to Walsh, keep going the way you're going. Roll out the endorsements, play the blue collar card. Pretty much keep what you're going and come up, for God's sakes, with an answer to this arbitration issue, one way or the other. To John Connolly, I'd say, take the money. Take the money. And I would tell him, here's
the so-called outside money so you can compete. Yeah.
Because here's the difference.
Take the money.
Marty Walsh's field organization compensates for the plus or minus swings in the poll. And
that's why most people thought he came in number one in the preliminary, correct? That it was the field operation that couldn't be spotted by pollsters who had him.
Exactly. And imagine this. Imagine a pouring, rainy day on election day, and your voters aren't coming out. So my final advice is take the money.
Do you think it matters to anybody? I know there's a gender gap with more women being with Connolly than with Walsh. Do you think it matters to anybody that Connolly's a married guy with three kids under six and a newborn baby and an adorable wife, and Walsh has got a very lovely girlfriend, but he's not a married guy and he has no kids? Does anybody care about that?
I don't think that it was an accident that that the first ad, general election ad that John Connolly came out with featured his wife, or that his wife was standing next to him at the press avail after the election. I don't think he's going to, I don't think there's anything you can say about it, but I think that they want to subtly make the point. I think that there are, I think that they think that in some ways it does play a role to some people.
They're like me, is the notion. That family is like your family. Isn't
that's
that
right.
the naive?
That's right. Yeah. And he's got kids,
I think that's what accountants call, though, a sunk cost. I mean, that's already been factored into the
equation.
I think
that's right.
Yeah.
Okay, so David, you can end with the answer to the same question. You're sitting down one-on-one with Connolly, then Walsh. What do you tell him to do for the final 20 days to separate himself from the other guy?
Yeah, I think that Walsh is going to have to go on the attack against Connolly. I think he does have to. Clearly, he got advice going into the debate to just not talk about the labor stuff. That was what he tried to do.
Go on attack on what issues?
Well, I think he needs to find, find some issues, whether it's taking some distinction about his about some of the education stuff, say, you want to go too far on this and this is why, or, here's something you did or here's why I think your vote against the BTU contract was a mistake, or here's where I thought you've tried to play cute, but really you he's got to come against John Connolly, because I really do think that if he doesn't put a dent in John Connolly, it's going to be tough for him to overcome the advantages that Connolly has.
Even with that legendary field operation that we all just
spoke read
about
my post from a couple days ago. I don't think that actually plays as big a role. I think it plays a role in how he got to be among the top tier. I think it's important to him in spreading the word, and it was important to him in terms of how many people came out in Dorchester in a preliminary. But I argue in a post that I put up recently that the big difference that between the polls that we saw and the result that was that he hadn't run any ads before those when those polls were taken, and then he ran $1 million worth of ads. You know, you know, that was, to my mind, I think that it plays the actual sort of get out the vote that, you know, operation that doesn't get picked up by polls, I think, is minimal.
David Bernstein, Peter Katz, this is a pleasure. We'll talk to you a lot between now and Election Day, and talk to you a lot before our debate, that's for sure.
Yeah, Peter and David are our WGBH political analysts. David Bernstein is also contributing editor to Boston Magazine. And I want to tell you guys, the next debate will be on WGBH News and TV Tuesday at 7 o'clock, 7 to 8. Jim and I are moderating, and we'd love to have you tweet your questions to at Boss Public Radio or send us emails at bpr@wgbh.org. When we come back, we're going to look at white-collar crime. This is something that annually eats up $37 billion and happens 11 million times, not even 1 million, 11 million times a day. You know what that is? It's the office meeting. How bad are they? What can be done to make them better? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Islam, American style?
I describe myself as the pork-eating, alcohol-drinking, premarital, sex-having variety of Muslim.
Young Muslims in America, the living voices of spiritual tolerance and secular life colliding with religious tradition. There's more than one way to read a holy Quran. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Atlas Liquors, in business since the end of Prohibition. You can visit Natalie and her brothers in Medford, Quincy, and Roslindale, or you can check Atlas Liquors on Facebook for current offerings of limited releases. And the Massachusetts STEM Summit at Gillette Stadium, November 13th, supported by Verizon and others championing STEM education throughout the state. More at mass-stem-summit.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Yesterday, Harvard Business School professor Nancy Kane joined us for open mic. Here's one of the things she had to say about the office meeting.
Mothers are incredibly good meeting managers, right? And they get through all kinds of stuff all the time. And they and I think we just need some more pure, practical, on-the-street common sense in corporate America. I'm really struck by this.
Now, she made the case yesterday, I thought quite eloquently, that when it comes to meetings, we need common sense. As you heard, they need to start on time. They need to have a purpose. There needs to be coffee and a good dose of common decency. So we want to know what your office meeting horror stories are. What are things that work as well? You can call in anonymously if you choose, if you're afraid of ratting out your boss. Our number is 877-301-8970. Again, that's 877-301-8970. 8970. Let me say, a good office meeting, like many of our morning meetings, we have, is great. I mean, there's all this thinking and creativity running around the room. A bad office meeting is not just horrible when you're in it, but it can bring you down all day. One, the anticipation of it. When you know a horrible meeting is about to come, you're thinking, you're dreading it. You sit through this horror show, and then the horror show is over, and you're recovering from it for the rest of the day. So the notion, and Nancy knows what she's talking about, 11 million office meetings a day is staggering. So we want to know what's the best and the worst. And if you have a prescription for a better office meeting, like Nancy Kane has written about and spoken about, please give us a buzz. And by the way, the notion, the most important thing she said, and everything was right on point. One, starting on time and ending on time is huge. Two, if you're in a meeting that's more than 30 minutes, if you are not decent enough to provide at least access to coffee and maybe a scone or something, you don't deserve to hold a meeting. And the third thing that is huge, and I'm an offender,
I admit. You are an offender.
So
I
you have to say,
she
starts the meeting. She says, you start a meeting if you're the boss or whoever's running the meeting. You, without saying a word, place your cell phone in the middle of the table, obviously off or on silent. You put it in the middle of the table, and without saying a word, and I believe this, she says everybody else will follow suit. They'll think, well, if the boss is doing that, I'm supposed to do it too. And there's a mound of cell phones in the middle.
Well, you know, you just don't feel quite right when you're making a point in an office meeting and you look around the room and everybody else is texting, you know, or they're listening to their voicemail.
But there's a key.
And you're trying to say something that maybe, you know, has some relevance to the office of politics and They're ignoring you completely.
There's a way to do that, by
What's
the way.
What's that?
Is you either stand or sit behind the person conducting the meeting, and then you can text all you want. 877-301-897. You know what's amazing to me? When I read the couple of pieces that Nancy had written about this, it is one of the banes of the existences of virtually everybody who works in an office setting. And the fact that there's so little attention. I've worked at a ton of places. Some of them are run brilliantly. They're quick. They're focused, whatever. Some are run abysmally. And there's so much focus on everything in business, nonprofit, profit, whatever. The fact that there's so little attention given to something that is so central to the running of an office meeting, is amazing. It's just amazing.
Well, you know
me.
What else she said? And if people, we get some emails of people looking for Nancy Kane. It's K-O-E-H-N.
Yes,
it's
it is.
It's a different spelling. She teaches at Harvard Business School. You can look for her stuff on our website from yesterday, and you can also look her up at Harvard Business School. She's written a lot about meetings, and she's a really clever writer as well. But she was talking about how you want to have 3 points. And you send
maximum.
Them out, yes, and you send them out via email the night before so everybody knows this is the agenda. So you don't get off on all these side things. That's what happens. You go to these meetings, and in my career, actually, I've almost never, ever been to meetings because when you're a reporter, you only have to worry about yourself, and it's really great not to worry about anybody else. But I notice now that I'm going to more meetings, and when I had been to meetings previously, you start talking about A, and suddenly you're talking about F, and then before you know it, you're talking about Q. You know what I mean? And you're way off
I do.
On a tangent, and people are looking at their watches, and everybody proceeds from Q to Z, and you never solve A.
Well, the key, again, to get through that is just to be texting through the meeting. 877-301-8970. What's the worst you've experienced? And if you want to add a list to Nancy Kane's 8 rules to improve meetings, we've given you about 4 or 5 mm-hmm. of them. And if you weren't listening yesterday, we'll give you the other ones in a couple of seconds. Please give us a buzz.
You know what is the worst?
What's that?
When you have someone that falls asleep at the meeting. And not only do they fall asleep, but they start to snore. And then you know, and it's always, do you wake them up or do you just let them sit there and snore? And
just put something in their mouth. You put a little feather in there, it'll wake them up and it'll be like no harm, I mean, no
that's
foul.
That's just the worst. That always makes the boss really, enamored of the person that's
Can
snoring,
I tell you
doesn't
the
it?
Flip the flip thing?
What?
Having someone who runs, as while we're talking about how horrible a horror meeting is, if you have somebody running a meeting that is engaging, that is electric, that is quick, that is focused, where you're fed, all the rule, Nancy's rules of the road,
yeah.
Meeting can be a fabulously inspirational, creative kind of thing that really juices you up for the rest of the day. So it doesn't have to be just passable. It can be, and it occasionally is. It's great. Let's go to Mendon. Let's start in Mendon with Steve. You're on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about meetings on Boston Public Radio. Jim and Marjorie. Hi, Steve.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
Most interesting meeting I ever went to, and I had a couple of them. I was a vendor up in Anchorage, Alaska,
mm-hmm.
To BP, British Petroleum.
Oh, yes.
Their conference rooms were small, had no table and no chairs. They had a large 8-inch-high, 6-foot-long Burroughs display, digital display across the end of the conference room. And as every BP employee entered that room, they had to swipe their badge. Their loaded cost was added up and displayed, updated every minute, on the Burroughs display. You had a continuous notice of exactly what this meeting was costing BP.
That is unbelievable.
That's hysterical. That is hysterical.
Now, Steve, did they have a companion a clock that was computing the cost of the oil spill in the Gulf, or did they not? Yeah, that is actually a fabulous idea. Steve, thank you for the call. I also like the idea, assuming that everybody can do this, of no chairs, no – I mean, there's higher energy level,
I guess,
which is great.
Where are you going to put your stuff if there's no table?
Well, I don't know.
The coffee and the crudités or –
Crudités. I don't know if we're talking about crudités. Let's go to
– I think nothing like a little crudité, the meaning everybody chew their raw broccoli.
Let's go to Ann in a car. You were on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the art of the meeting. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Well, I'm in my car, and it really piqued my interest because I ran the company for 30 years, and it might have taken 15 of the 30 years to figure this out, but certainly email helped. We would publish the content of the agenda a couple of days before, and we'd ask for submissions. and so that we could present the agenda the day before. If it wasn't on the agenda, it didn't get talked about.
So when people got your original memo, if they added something to the agenda and you bought into that, the participants would know 24 hours in advance that the agenda had been amended. Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
I like it. But, you know, Nancy Kane's rule is for most meetings, three agenda items are the most that anybody can handle. How many did you have on yours?
Well, sometimes we didn't have a meeting every week. So it would be, we'd have a 1 hour meeting once a month. And so we could have 10 items on the agenda.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not bad.
But we only had 1 hour.
Yeah, 1 hour.
Complete. So,
well, that's huge. And did you always end on the within 60 minutes as promised?
We did.
That's
and
huge.
If we had to say, we cannot complete this at this meeting, let's take it.
Great.
Outside of the meeting, it's really important. People are really interested in this item.
And did you serve those little cocktail pigs in blankets too? A little mustard dip or
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Thank you for the call.
You want really hot mustard, so when you have it, you know, wakes you right up if you're falling asleep. We have this email from the Bushy speaking of falling asleep. He says, how about a meeting so bloody boring and useless that the motion detector lights in the conference room went off in the middle of the meeting because no one had moved a muscle literally in a half an hour?
That is great.
That is really great. I mean, it is awful when you feel like you're going to fall asleep at one of these.
You ever had that experience, Marjorie?
Falling asleep at a meeting?
No. Sitting in a meeting where absolutely nothing happened and no one spoke for extended periods of time?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. Let's leave it at that. Yeah, we both have.
Okay.
Let's just leave it there. Thank you. 877. Just wanted to pique her, whatever. 877-301-8970. Tracy, and those are theoretical meetings we're talking about. Tracy, you're in Hanover. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Our number is 877-301-8970. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, guys. I have a worth meeting moment.
Please.
Our boss was, there were eight of us running different districts throughout the Northeast. Our boss was struggling, so her boss called us into a meeting from all over the Northeast, made us wait for 45 minutes in there. We had no idea what the meeting was about. And then when he finally came into the meeting, he said to us, your job is to make your boss look good.
Oh, creepy.
It was awful. And then we had to sit there and he went on and on, you know, at us, blamed us, whatever. And it was, you know, she was struggling with some things. So I actually left the meeting. And when I got back to my office, I was so mad. I called him and I told him that my job was to make the company look good, not my boss.
And what kind of response did you get?
He was fired 3 months later.
Oh, well, there you go. There is some justice.
So I didn't care what his response was because I knew that he was inept too.
You know,
Tracy, thanks.
Tracy, thank you for the call. Where did the expression "take a meeting" come from? Is that Hollywood?
I hate the expression.
I'm gonna. We should.
I don't know
take
where it comes
meeting.
From. I don't know.
Do
I don't
you
like
say
it.
That, Jim?
No, I don't. I've never said it, and I don't intend to.
And I often find when you're in one of those meetings where no one is talking, I find that very difficult. I need to interject some discussion of the weather or comment on somebody's clothing or something. But you manage Zen-like to sit there indefinitely without saying
theoretically,
a word.
At the theoretical
meeting.
By the way,
correct.
There should be a rule. You know how there's the 5-second rule that if food drops on the floor, that if it's there for fewer than 5 seconds, you can eat it?
Yeah.
There should be a 15-second rule that if no one speaks in a meeting for 15 seconds, the meeting is automatically adjourned.
How would you approach that? Would you say, gotta go, or that's it, or what's
happened?
Well,
in this theoretical meeting setting where no one said anything, I guess what I would have done, maybe, is I said, well, I guess the meeting is over, and I would leave. And when I would leave, the interesting thing in this theoretical meeting is that everybody else was still there. And somebody who I know quite well was angry. Why did you leave? And I said, because nothing was going on. Fred, you're in Maine. We're talking about the good and the bad of office meetings. Fred, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hey, guys. Listen, I'm timing this call to make sure I stay within my own meeting limit, which is about 30 seconds.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I've got an ethnic F meeting, I've got an international F meeting story, and I've got a meeting that never happened story. You want to pick one?
You choose. Well, meeting never happened is pretty good. Start with
which
that.
Which is your best?
Okay, this is major. Okay, this was a senior officer at a major insurance company was just taken over by another company, and they canceled the company plane, they canceled the company jet, told this senior officer to be in New York for this meeting at 8 o'clock in the morning. I had to take a train. He gets down there. They say, oh, the boss is going to be late. Can you just sit tight? How about some coffee? 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. The meeting's running over. The boss will be in soon. Can you take lunch? He got back from lunch, waited till 4 o'clock. They said, we're going to reschedule the meeting for tomorrow.
Oh, that's terrible.
That was the meeting. True story. A senior, that meeting, that officer left that company because that was the whole idea, was to drive the officers out of the company by humiliating them by not having meetings that they called.
It's a hell of a management technique, Fred. Fred, thank you for sharing your story with us. 877-301-8970. If you weren't listening to Nancy yesterday, what she wrote, and these sound so simple. I said this to Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School yesterday. They sound simple, but they're not done, so they need saying. One, consider holding fewer, more productive meetings. Fairly obvious. If you don't need it, don't do it. Limit the number of attendees to those essential to the meeting's purpose. Or, by the way, if there's a point at which it's not necessary for everybody in the meeting to still be there, let some of them go. Clarify the intent of the meeting, which people have said. Start and end on time, which I think is the single most important notion. If you call a meeting for 10 o'clock, it's got to start at 10 o'clock. And if you promise people, as I would think that woman Ann said, that it's going to be an over in an hour, it has to be. Schedule shorter meetings. Provide fuel for the journey. That's the food. That's the crudités.
Crudités.
As Marjorie said.
That's right.
Make a conscious decision to manage the energy of the group. This is really important. Means, and here's what she writes. This means walking into the meeting room with your head up, not looking at your smartphone, with your face and upper body open and expectant, and your overall bearing confident. And then the thing we mentioned, begin the meeting by turning off your own smartphone, placing it in the center of the conference room table. And again, the part of that I love the most, Marjorie, is you don't say a word. You don't say, please all do the same
right.
thing.
I love
you
that.
Just do it, and everybody knows by virtue of your own behavior as the leader of the group, it's incumbent on them to match you.
You know, Ben just emailed from Natick saying that a friend of his works for a company where key people have a license to kill a meeting if it's not productive.
What does that mean?
They can just terminate it on the spot. They're
what, unilaterally?
People, they said, yep, they can just say, the meeting is over, everybody's got to leave. That would not enamor you again. That would not build you, if you're an underling person, you're
email us back on that. What's the guy's name, Bill?
Ben.
Email us again and tell us exactly what you're talking about. Laura, you're in Wellesley. You're on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the good and bad of office meetings. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thank you for making it.
I was listening to Nancy yesterday and just laughing my face off.
She's
because
great.
I remember I was working for this one company back in Maryland, and we provided nurses to hospitals on a per diem basis. And I used to love meetings because it was essentially the boss would get us all together, all four of us, and she would wring her hands telling us all of these wonderful things she needed to do, and she would never do them. But it meant that we didn't have to work for about 45 minutes while we would listen to her in a wonderful plan of attack for the week. So I work for a company now where our meetings are extraordinarily effective, although they are long, but when you guys were talking about ineffective meetings, oh my goodness, I just went back to my first job in Maryland and I thought, oh.
But that's a good point.
Which part is a good point?
It is a good point. If you want to take a break from the drudgery of your day and your boss calls a meeting for an hour and a half, you can just sit around there daydreaming, which apparently 91% of people at meetings do anyway.
Well, you should say that's not made up.
91%
of people.
Nancy Kane. She said that yesterday. That was one of the surveys that she did, that that people daydream most of the people are daydreaming during these meetings. So you're right, Laura. You could kind of get a little break in the action and just daydream.
Doesn't work for me.
Think about your dinner or something.
Laura, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. My blood pressure goes when you're sitting in a particularly long meeting.
Theoretical meeting that you're referring to, Jim?
No, well, not those theoretical meetings. But when you're sitting in particularly a long meeting where absolutely nothing is being accomplished, and you realize you actually have some other things you prefer to do or are required to do, you can't. What's the word you just said? You just take advantage of the wonderful waste of time? No, you don't. You feel totally stressed. And you feel like you're being taken away from what really matters.
Not everybody. Some people.
Well, you're exactly the same way.
As a break in the day.
Would you feel it was a break in the day? No, you would not.
No, well, it's different. It depends what you're doing. If you're doing something you're really anxious to get away from, then you might have a different perspective. I mean, I know that you are doing very important work, Jim, so in your case, you would not want to get
away
from it.
Most days, that's true. Let's squeeze in one more quick one. Steve, you're in Grafton. You're on Boston Public Radio. You'll end things. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing? This is my most embarrassing meeting. It almost resulted in my being fired. I was a teacher coach, and we got rained out that day. So I thought I would attend a meeting on the budget with the superintendent.
Sure.
And I was the last one in the room and had to sit right in front of the podium. 10 minutes into the meeting, I fell asleep. And I guess he was looking at me, and suddenly I woke up with a Jerry Cheever's kick save and almost knocked the person over.
Oh,
next
no.
To me. And you know that feeling you get when you suddenly wake up.
Oh.
He went looking for me, but couldn't find me after the meeting. So,
well, that's, you're an honest man. Thank you, Steve, for
falling
sharing
asleep
that.
In a meeting is always an embarrassing
no,
situation.
Steve made a very good point. You know what's worse than falling asleep in a meeting?
What?
Waking up in the meeting and realizing people knew that you were asleep.
Okay, thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Valerie Plame. She joins us to talk about her new book. It's fiction. It's called Blowback. Christopher Lydon is with us as well. And we want to tell you, Jim and I are moderating the next debate in the mayor's race in Boston on WGBH News and on television next Tuesday. We'd love to get your input. Tweet your questions to @BossPublicRadio or send us emails at bpr@wgbh.org. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
And thanks again for tuning in. Talk to you tomorrow.